Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
In June of 2025, as we're recording this literally yesterday, but who knows when you're watching this, Barry Morphew was arrested again for the murder of his wife, Suzanne. The same man, the same charge, but this time, prosecutors claim they had one thing they didn't have before. This time, they had Suzanne's body. Her remains were found in a shallow grave buried off a remote road in Sagache County, Colorado, roughly 40 miles south of the house that she vanished from. There wasn't much left, mostly bones, but what investigators found inside them was enough to light the match all over again. According to the state, those remains carried chemical traces of a tranquilizer used to sedate large animals. And the only person in the region known to have access to that particular cocktail, allegedly, Barry Morphew. We're going to dive into this case from the beginning. We're going to tell the story from the beginning as we understand it to get us up to where we are today. In case you're brand new to this case and you want the full recap, you are in the right place. This video, this audio, wherever you're listening, watching, should catch you up. And while you're getting caught up, please do me a favor, hit subscribe wherever you're listening to this and whatever podcast platform, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iTunes, where anything it may be. iHeart, it is all there. And on YouTube, please hit subscribe there as well so you don't miss any of our updates. And please, in the comment section, let me know where you're at on this story. What do you think of Barry? Is he innocent of all these charges? His daughters have stood by his side the entire time. The very children that he shared with his deceased wife, they do not believe, as of right now, that Barry had anything to do with her death. Let's go into the whole story. And then you can start to express your opinions. Be curious to hear yours. So, this story doesn't start in a grave. It starts in a small Indiana town with two high school sweethearts. Barry and Suzanne met in Alexandria. He was the hometown sports star, eventually drafted by the Toronto Blue Jays. She was smart, upbeat, and the kind of person everyone described as glowing, even before she survived cancer twice. They married in 1994, raised two daughters, and for years lived what looked like a picture-perfect life. Barry ran a successful landscaping business. Suzanne left her job as a middle school teacher to focus on raising their kids. From the outside, it all tracked. God, family, grit, but like most glossy images, the closer you look, the more it started to smudge. In 2018, they made a big move, leaving Indiana behind and settling in a secluded home just outside of Salida, Colorado. Officially, the story was that they wanted to be closer to one of their daughters attending college out west. Unofficially, it was a reset button. Friends described the move as a new beginning, but one that carried quiet tension. The marriage allegedly was not thriving. Suzanne seemed to be shrinking inside it, and over the next 2 years, those cracks turned into fault lines. By 2019, Suzanne had reconnected with a man from her past, a former high school classmate living in Michigan. Their relationship escalated from catch-up messages to full-on romantic affair. It wasn't a fling. They spoke daily. Allegedly, he knew about her cancer history, her fears, the problems in her marriage. She'd sent him videos from Colorado, biking, sunbathing, joking with her daughters, and by early 2020, Suzanne was making plans to leave Barry. Quietly, carefully. She had confided in friends that she was scared of how he might react. In one text, she wrote plainly, "I'm done. Let's figure this out civilly." That message was sent on May 6, 2020. 3 days later, she was gone. Mother's Day weekend was supposed to be simple. Their daughters were away camping. Barry said he was home with Suzanne on Saturday, May 9th. They grilled. They spent time together. Everything was fine, allegedly. But that version quickly unraveled at 2:11 p.m. that Saturday. Suzanne sent her last known message, a selfie, to her lover, lying on a patio chair, sun in her face, and then nothing. She didn't respond to his text messages. She didn't text her daughters back. The digital trail just stopped. Around the same time, Barry's phone began pinging around their property in a way that investigators later called erratic. His story? He said he was hunting around outside, shooting chipmunks. That was his explanation for the burst of GPS activity. And yes, that's a real quote. Chipmunks. And hey, look, I have to confess, as a child, we had chipmunk problems too. I'm not proud of it, but I had a Red Ryder BB gun and I had instructions from my father. I wouldn't do it today, but it can be a thing. Then, not long after, his phone went into airline mode and stayed that way for most of the night. His truck data would later show he was backed up to the garage around 9:30 p.m. Backed up to the garage. It showed that it went from one space to backing up to the garage. That's a key point. Even though Barry told investigators he'd gone to bed by 8. By Sunday morning, Barry was out of the house by 5 a.m., heading to a landscaping job site in Broomfield, roughly 150 miles away. He claimed Suzanne was still sleeping when he left. Later that day, when their daughter couldn't reach her, they asked a neighbor to check in. The house was locked. Suzanne's car was still in the driveway. Her purse and keys were inside, but Suzanne was nowhere. Barry contacted by the neighbor, told her to look in the garage and see if Suzanne's bike was gone. That detail, asking about the bike, raised more than a few eyebrows. That evening, law enforcement found the bike ditched down an embankment not far from the house. It wasn't wrecked, no blood, no torn clothes, no sign of struggle, just placed there like a prop. The next day, they found her bike helmet tossed off the side of a highway a mile away. Again, no sign of trauma, nothing that suggested an actual bike accident, and no Suzanne. That was when everything changed. This wasn't a search and rescue mission anymore. It was a missing persons case. With a fog of foul play. Over the next few weeks, the search for Suzanne exploded. Helicopters, drones, cadaver dogs, dive teams in the rivers, hundreds of volunteers fanning out across the terrain. Her brother Andy flew in from Indiana and launched his own independent search effort. Everyone was looking except, allegedly, Barry. He didn't participate in the volunteer searches. Instead, he recorded a short video pleading for Suzanne's return, offering $200,000 as a reward. He looked emotional. Said he missed her. Said the girls needed her, but was it from the heart? That's what everyone asked. Meanwhile, investigators were already building their timeline. Suzanne's last known digital communication was that at 2:11 p.m., that selfie. Barry's movements, both his phone and his truck, started to look questionable. His trip the next day to Broomfield included 5 separate stops at commercial dumpsters. Gas stations, hotel parking lots, a random alley. Surveillance footage captured him tossing trash bags into multiple bins. You know, like you do the day after your wife goes missing. When investigators asked what he'd thrown away, he gave vague answers. Construction materials, maybe. Leftovers from a job, nothing important. But no receipts, no details, and by the time law enforcement traced the route, the garbage had already been collected and destroyed. Back at the house, things weren't adding up either. Investigators found a cracked door frame in the master bedroom, like it had been forced open. Barry claimed not to know anything about it. Then came something even more unusual. An empty plastic cap, the kind used to seal tranquilizer darts, found in the laundry. Barry owned a .22 caliber dart rifle and had a history of tranquilizing deer illegally back in Indiana. He'd even talked about it on record, cutting the antlers off bucks while they were sedated. He called it business. Investigators called it a pattern. The law calls it illegal. Then they found the pen. Hidden in a closet, a voice-activated recorder Suzanne had allegedly bought to try to catch Barry cheating. What it caught instead was her own conversations with her lover. With friends, recordings of a woman who felt emotionally stuck, fearful, and determined to leave. It was all there in her voice, in her words. But there was no body, no direct evidence of murder, no forensic smoking gun, and for months, that was the limbo investigators lived in. Suzanne was gone, and they story didn't make sense. Barry's behavior, from the chipmunk story to the trash runs to the silence, only made it stranger. By the end of 2020, Suzanne Morphew had been missing for over half a year. There were no public charges, no dramatic arrests, but behind closed doors, law enforcement was quietly assembling their case. A year after Suzanne vanished, they would finally make their move. And Barry Morphew would be in handcuffs. Not because they'd found a body, but because they believed they'd found enough. They thought they had him. In May of 2021, Barry Morphew was arrested for the murder of his wife, Suzanne. It had been just under a year since she vanished on Mother's Day weekend, and investigators believed they'd finally built a case strong enough to take down the man they'd quietly been circling for months. No body, no confession, no murder weapon. But they had data, timelines, inconsistencies, and a theory. And it was a theory they believed explained everything, right down to the way Barry had allegedly staged a mountain bike crash in the woods like it was a low-budget crime reenactment. What changed the game for prosecutors wasn't some dramatic discovery. It was the slow accumulation of behavioral and digital breadcrumbs. One of the biggest came from Barry's phone. On May 9th, the same day Suzanne sent her final selfie, Barry's cell started doing things that didn't match his story. He claimed he was outside the house, relaxing, maybe taking care of a few chores, but his GPS data showed otherwise. The phone pinged erratically around the property and in and out of the garage, around the backyard, at one point hitting speeds that made no sense on foot. When asked, Barry gave what would become one of the more infamous responses of the investigation. Again, said he was hunting chipmunks. Then came the data from his truck. According to the vehicle's internal telematics, it was reversed into the garage late that evening, specifically around 9:30 p.m. That's a detail Barry hadn't shared. He told investigators he'd gone to bed by 8. So either the truck was parking itself, or someone wasn't being entirely truthful. That late-night movement paired with the phone going into airplane mode for hours painted a picture that didn't sit well with investigators. But what really elevated the suspicion into action was the discovery of a smell, seemingly innocuous piece of plastic in the family's laundry room, a dart cap, the kind that seals the end of a tranquilizer dart. Now, on its own, a plastic cap might not mean much. But Barry Morphew wasn't just anyone. He had a long history of using tranquilizer darts, not for veterinary work or wildlife conservation, but for sedating bucks, sawing off their antlers and selling them. According to his own statements, this was something he'd done back in Indiana. It was illegal, and he didn't exactly hide it. Inside the Colorado home, investigators found the dart gun, disassembled, tucked into a safe. There was also boxes of darts, but no records of veterinary use. Barry claimed it was an old hobby, nothing more. But with Suzanne missing and the dart cap showing up in the wash, investigators began to piece together a theory that Barry had used one of those darts or something similar to take Susan down without leaving visible injuries, then dispose of her body before staging the bike crash, allegedly. By this point, investigators had already uncovered the spy pen in Suzanne's closet. That voice-activated recorder, something she'd allegedly purchased to catch Barry cheating instead of caught her. Specifically, it picked up Suzanne speaking with her lover, Jeff Lieber, a man she'd known in high school, reconnected with decades later, and carried on a secret relationship for nearly 2 years. Those recordings made one thing clear. Suzanne was done. She was planning to leave. She had confided in friends and even put it in writing. Text showed her telling Barry directly, "I'm done. Let's handle this civilly." For investigators, it wasn't background noise, it was motive. But there were still gaps. Suzanne was missing, Barry was saying all the right things in public, and so the case simmered until the anniversary of her disappearance, when prosecutors decided they were ready. Then, like I said, May 5th, 21, Barry was arrested and charged with first-degree murder, tampering with a human body, tampering with physical evidence, and attempting to influence a public official. The last one tied to inconsistent statements he'd allegedly given during the investigation. The arrest affidavit was over 100 pages long. Inside it was a full timeline, GPS data, phone logs, truck movements, interview excerpts, and expert analysis. Investigators laid out their version of events. Barry, they claimed, had learned about the affair, knew Suzanne wanted to leave, and decided to stop her. They believe he killed her on the afternoon of May 9th, transported her body in his truck, and staged the bike scene to make it look like an accident. By the time Suzanne was reported missing on May 10th, the cleanup had already begun. Part of that cleanup, according to investigators, included a bizarre sequence of dumpster visits. On the morning of May 10th, Barry made five separate stops to throw away trash. Not at one convenience spot, but scattered across Broomfield, a hotel dumpster, gas station, fast food parking lot. Each time he discarded bags. When asked what he threw away, he couldn't remember. Investigators found that convenient. Unfortunately for them, by the time they tracked down the dumpsters, the trash indeed was gone. Despite the circumstantial nature of the evidence, the DA moved forward. Suzanne's body hadn't been found, but prosecutors felt they had enough. Suzanne's affair, Barry's haunting background, the strange phone and truck data, the missing trash, the dart cap, and the alleged lies. Even Barry's lack of urgency when Suzanne was missing. Not calling her, not rushing home, not asking a lot of questions, allegedly, became part of the narrative. As one investigator noted, his behavior was not what we would expect from a concerned husband. The defense, led by attorney Iris Eaton, wasn't varying any of it. Their position was simple. The state had built a story, not a case. Eaton argued that everything presented was circumstantial, speculative, and in some cases just flat out wrong. And then she went for the jugular. She revealed that law enforcement had discovered unknown male DNA in Suzanne's Range Rover, specifically inside the glove box. DNA that did not belong to Barry. That DNA had been matched through the CODIS system to profiles from unsolved sexual assaults in other states. Not only did this DNA that had been discovered, but the defense claimed it had not been properly disclosed in the timely manner. They alleged the DA's office had failed to turn over several expert reports and updates, violating discovery rules. The judge agreed. Sanctions were issued. 14 of the prosecutor's 16 witnesses did not get to go on the stand. Big, big deal in this case. And look, that's not just a procedural slap on the wrist. These were the very experts the prosecution planned to lean on to explain the technical evidence, the data from Barry's truck, the forensic interpretation of the phone movements, the lab results from Suzanne's belongings. It included DNA experts, vehicle telematic analytics, and analysts, cell site location specialists, even digital forensic examiners. Without them, the state had no expert testimony to explain the heart of its case to the jury. The people meant to walk the jury through the science had been benched because the prosecution failed to follow the rules. Judge Ramsey Lama didn't mince words. He said the state had shown a pattern of neglect and arguably reckless disregard for their disclosure obligations. He didn't go as far as declaring their conduct willful or malicious, but he made it clear that they had repeatedly failed to comply with court orders. It wasn't just one mistake, it was systematic, the kind of breakdown that doesn't happen unless multiple people drop the ball and keep dropping it. At that point, the state's options were shrinking by the hour. With most of their forensic experts off the table and no body to present to the jury, their case looked less like a murder trial and more like a minefield. If they move forward, they'd risk having a jury hear only part of the story, with no expert voices to explain the digital and forensic trail they'd spent months developing. So instead, they filed a motion to dismiss. April 19th of 2022, 9 days before jury selection, prosecutors submitted a formal request to drop the case against Barry Morphew, without prejudice. The last part is key. Dismissing a case without prejudice means it's not over for good. They can be refiled in new evidence if new evidence comes to light. Not an acquittal. It's more like pressing pause while you scramble to find something you missed. In the motion, they pointed to a specific lead, a remote mountainous area near the Morphew home that investigators believe could contain Suzanne's remains. The problem was, at the time, it was buried under feet of snow. They argued that the terrain was inaccessible and that it would be irresponsible to proceed with trial before they had a chance to fully search the area. If Suzanne's body was there, It could hold answers, cause of death evidence, of trauma, maybe even DNA. Without it, the trial would go forward with a gaping hole in the middle of the state's theory. But while snow-covered mountains made for a practical excuse, it wasn't lost on anyone that the timing coincided exactly with the aftermath of the judge's ruling. The prosecution's core expert testimony had been stripped away. Key elements of their evidence were now inadmissible. The case hadn't just been weakened, it had been kneecapped. And with each step, it became clear that they were walking into a trial that wasn't just high risk, it was possibly unwinnable. Judge Lama approved the dismissal. He acknowledged the motion as being in the interest of justice and emphasized that the dismissal was without prejudice. The door was left wide open. If the state found Suzanne's body or uncovered new legally admissible evidence, they could come back and try again. The judge didn't condemn the case as unfounded, but he didn't hide his frustration with how badly it had been handled. Barry Morphew walked out of the court that day with no charges handed to him. Not exonerated, not declared innocent, but free. And for the first time in nearly a year, no court date on the calendar. His defense team wasted no time. Iris Eaton stepped in front of microphones and cameras and told the world that they'd been saying behind closed doors for months, that this case never should have been brought. That Barry Morphew had been dragged through a year of legal hell because the state built a theory and ignored anything that didn't fit. She pointed to the unknown male DNA, to the hidden reports, to the evidence that had been lost, buried, or withheld. She called the dismissal a complete collapse of a prosecution that never had the facts on its side to begin with. Outside the courtroom, public reaction was split. Some still believe Barry was responsible and saw the dismissal as a temporary hiccup. Others were stunned that such a high-profile murder case could disintegrate so completely, so quickly, not because of new developments, but because of the prosecution's own missteps. Legal analysts called it one of the most dramatic pretrial breakdowns in recent memory. A few even questioned why the case had been filed so early before Suzanne's body had been found, before the forensic evidence was fully reviewed, before expert opinions were locked in. And then there was Linda Stanley, a DA who brought the charge in the first place. The fallout from her office's handling of the case was already beginning. Questions about ethics, discovery violations, and professional conduct started mounting. Stanley had given interviews, appeared on podcasts, made statements to the media while the case was still pending. Eventually, she would face formal disciplinary proceedings. Her law license would be suspended, and the story of Barry Morphew wouldn't just be about a missing woman. It would be about a collapsed prosecution, a disbarred DA, and a legal system forced to admit that it broke its own rules. Barry, meanwhile, filed a $15 million federal civil rights lawsuit claiming he was wrongfully charged and maliciously prosecuted. The suit would eventually be dismissed, but it made its point. The scars from the failed case weren't going away anytime soon. And with the charges gone, the cases sat still for a while. No trial, no resolution, just a missing woman, a botched prosecution, and a question no one could yet answer. What really happened to Suzanne Morphew? It wasn't a tip. It wasn't a confession. It wasn't some hidden piece of evidence that had been missed. It was a search team working on an unrelated investigation who made the discovery that would reopen the entire case. September 22nd, 2023. Let's go there. Over 3 years after Suzanne Morphew vanished, a set of human remains were found buried in a shallow grave near the tiny town of Moffat, Colorado. Quiet, remote, population under 150. And there in a patch of scrub brush and dirt lay the answer to a question investigators had been chasing since Mother's Day 2020. Scattered bones, some personal items, a single rifle cartridge, and something small but unmistakable, a chemo port, still attached to one of the bones. That port, surgically implanted during Suzanne's cancer treatment years earlier, would become the key to identifying her remains. Forensic confirmation followed quickly, dental records matched, and 3.5 years, Suzanne Morphew had finally been found. But the story wasn't over. In many ways, it was just getting started. The scene in Moffat was sparse, her remains weren't fully intact, and they weren't nearly buried either. According to the forensic report, the bones showed signs of weather exposure, some sun bleaching, which meant she may have decomposed on the surface before being moved or buried. Her clothing was found nearby, mostly fragments consistent with athletic wear. She often wore biking, no purse, no phone, no wallet. And then there was a .22 caliber bullet found near the burial site. It wasn't lodged in bone, and there was no fractures or trauma consistent with a gunshot. Its presence raised questions, though, but not answers. The autopsy didn't reveal much at first. No obvious fractures, no signs of blunt force trauma, nothing that pointed cleanly to a cause of death. But forensic science doesn't just work with what you can see. Toxicology works with what remains. In this case, investigators submitted bone samples for chemical analysis, and that's where the break happened. Traces of a chemical sedative known as BAM were detected in Suzanne's bones, specifically a metabolite of the combination drug. And here's where I'm going to screw this up. Bertophenol, we'll go with that. Azapranone and Mendine, something like that. I said it's so bad, no one's going to be able to find these online and make your own BAM. Would not have done good as a scientist or anything in the chemical field. BAM, those three chemicals I could not pronounce, is used almost exclusively to tranquilize large animals, wildlife, zoo animals, elk, deer, bears, and it's not a recreational drug. It's not something you can come across by accident. And in the region where Suzanne was found, only one private citizen had ever legally obtained it. That citizen happened to be Barry Morphew. Investigators pulled veterinary supply records, confirmed that Barry, back when he lived in Indiana, had acquired BAM through animal tranquilizer vendors, allegedly for the purpose of sedating deer, removing antlers, and selling them. He talked about it openly. He even bragged about his method, said it was efficient, easy, untraceable. That history, combined with what they now had in their lab report, gave the case something it had never had before. Forensic evidence linking Suzanne's body to something only Barry had access to. The original DA who'd handled the case, Linda Stanley, was no longer involved. She'd been disbarred after a series of ethical violations, including how she handled discovery in the original prosecution. Her team had been sanctioned by the court, experts excluded, and the case had collapsed in 2022 under the weight of its own mistakes. So when Suzanne's body was found, it wasn't Stanley's office that picked up the file. It was a new district attorney from a different jurisdiction. Sagatchie County. Now overseeing a case that had crossed both geographic and legal boundaries. With the body now located and the forensic results in hand, the case was brought before a grand jury, not in Chaffee County, where the Morphews had lived, but in the jurisdiction where Suzanne was found. The grand jury reviewed months of evidence, including the toxicology, veterinary records, Barry's own statements, and the long-standing behavioral evidence that had once made up the backbone of the original prosecution. But this time, prosecutors didn't have to rely on behavioral patterns alone. This time, they had Suzanne's remains. And according to them, they had chemical proof that Barry, and only Barry, could have introduced BAM into her system, allegedly. The grand jury returned an indictment. In June of 2025, as of this recording, it was just yesterday. First-degree murder, tampering with a deceased human body, additional charges included under seal. Barry Morphew was arrested again, this time not in Colorado, but in Arizona, where he'd been living with his daughters since the charges were dropped in 2022. He'd taken into custody by the U.S. Marshals outside a residence in the Phoenix suburb of Gilbert. No resistance, no statement, just quiet handcuffs and the extradition process already in motion. The charges were announced publicly within hours. This time there was no press tour, no media stunts. The new district attorney, Ann Kelly, held a press conference confirming the indictment, the charges, and the jurisdiction. She said little else, but her message was clear. The case had never been closed. It had just been waiting for the right moment to move again. Barry's defense responded quickly through his new attorney. They issued a statement calling the re-indictment a rehash of the same weak case built on circumstantial guesses. They pointed to the same problems raised during the first prosecution. No eyewitness, no confession, no murder weapon, DNA in Suzanne's car that didn't belong to Barry. They also hinted at filing motions to suppress some of the forensic evidence, although as of this recording, those challenges haven't yet played out in court. The state, meanwhile, says this is a fundamentally different case now, because now there's a body, now there's chemical evidence, now there's a line connecting Suzanne's death, not just to motive or behavior, but to a specific substance, one Barry Morphew allegedly had both the knowledge and access to administer. The case will now move forward in the new county, a new courtroom, a new judge, a new jury pool. Extradition proceedings are already underway, and Barry is being held on bond pending transfer. His daughters, who publicly supported him during the first case, have not made any statements this time around yet, but it is very, very new. Neither has Jeff Lieber, Suzanne's former lover, who was long cleared of any involvement. There are still questions. The 22 round, the missing time between her disappearance and when her body was moved, because forensic analysts believe it was moved. The bones had sun exposure, the burial, the original staging of the bike, the helmet on the highway. There's no neat narrative yet, but the state doesn't need one to perfect the story. They need enough evidence to make their case beyond a reasonable doubt, and they believe they have that now. Barry Morphew is once again going to face a jury, once again face a possibility of life in prison, but this time, prosecutors aren't just trying to prove what he might have done. They're trying to show what the bones revealed. In the comments, let me know your thoughts on this story. Is this a slam dunk for the prosecution now that they have the chemicals that were in the dart that Barry allegedly had found in the toxicology of Suzanne? Or is there just too much circumstantial evidence that could point to another direction? DNA of another man in her vehicle. DNA allegedly traced in CODIS to sexual offenders. How does that get in one's car? There's a lot of questions. Tell me in the comments what your thoughts are on this story as it is relaunching right now. We thought may never come back is back. And we're going to follow it for you right here. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you're listening to this podcast so you don't miss our coverage on this. We're going to keep up on this one as it goes forward. And let me know in the comments on YouTube what your thoughts are. Be sure to search us on YouTube if you're not there right now watching. Hi, if you are, thank you. Hit subscribe. If you're listening to the podcast on a podcast platform, find us on YouTube. Just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Until next time, my name is Tony Bruschi. Thank you for listening. Thank you for watching. We will talk again real soon.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Drew McIntyre here from WWE. Wielding the Claymore can be a life of chaos. When I'm not dominating in the ring, Chumba Casino is how this warrior takes a wee break. With hundreds of online social games and new weekly releases, there's always something fresh to try. And those daily boosts, next level. Even my free time feels like Valhalla. So when life feels like a battle, kick up your feet, have some fun, and let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Looking for a little Hollywood-style fun? Check out Ryan Seacrest's 10K Ways exclusively at Chumba Casino. There's 10,000 ways to play. Get spinning for free at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.